This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, everybody. Richard Martin here. Nice to be back with you on this Monday morning. I suppose it's pretty snow-covered in your part of the world, although here it's the usual tropical, breezy, and sultry evening here, and wonderful it is. So anyway, thought I'd just start off with a little comment about President Obama's speech on the budget last week, which had the makings of a macabre joke. First of all, was this, and I quote, "The fact is, 10 years ago, we had a budget surplus of more than $200 billion, with projected surpluses stretching out towards the horizon. Yet over the course of the past 10 years, the previous administration and previous Congresses created an expansive new drug program, passed massive tax cuts for the wealthy, and funded two wars without paying for any of it, all of which was compounded by recession and by rising health care costs." End of quote. Well, of course, this is total and utter nonsense. The budget surplus of the late 1990s occurred because of increased taxes collected from the dot-com bubble. The dot-com bubble collapsed in 2000, the last year of the Clinton administration, and that's when the deficits started growing. Since then, the deficit has barely been affected at all by spending. The main factor was tax income. And that brings us to the next point. President Obama's claim that the deficit will start coming down in 2011 is based on the assumption that the economy will start growing rapidly by then, i.e., that the old credit and real estate bubbles will start to grow again. Ladies and gentlemen, that's not going to happen. As I mentioned last week while talking about the report from TARP Inspector, whose comment was, "We're driving off a cliff in a faster car," the economy is going to plummet sharply. So the $1.6 trillion deficit in 2010 and the $1.3 trillion deficit in 2011 are vast underestimates. The deficit is going to continue its exponential growth until there's a catastrophic financial crisis, which frankly can't be too far off now. Well, here's another excerpt from the president's speech, and I quote, "I've proposed a freeze in government spending for 3 years. This won't apply to the benefits folks getting through Social Security, Medicaid or Medicare, and it won't apply to our national security, including benefits for veterans, but it will apply to all other discretionary government programs. We're not simply photocopying last year's budget. Freezing spending doesn't mean we won't cut what doesn't work to pay for what does." End of quote. Do you see how moronic this is? There's going to be a freeze in government spending after government spending was substantially increased last year, so the freeze is at no less than last year's ridiculously high levels. And the freeze doesn't even apply to the biggest portions of the budget, just to sub-discretionary programs. Is there any proposal that's too ridiculous to be endorsed by President Obama? In fact, it was so outrageously egregious, he had to hold a special conference last week just to spin the news. The scope of the proposed budget for fiscal 2011 is $3.8 trillion. The difference between revenue and expenditures for this fiscal year will leave the U.S. with a deficit of $1.6 trillion, and amazingly enough, that shortfall will equal 10.6% of GDP, the highest since World War II, and $200 billion more than 2009. Next year's deficit is slated to post just a $300 billion reduction to $1.3 trillion. Now, while it is true that George W. Bush was a paragon of fiscal irresponsibility, it now seems past the time to be able to blame just Bush for the debt. Ladies and gentlemen, just to give you a bit of perspective on how far we've gone off the fiscal rails, the budget for all of 2001 was just $1.9 trillion. Going forward, the administration is projecting annual deficits between $700 billion and $1 trillion through 2020, which would add $8.5 trillion to the nation's debt. The annual deficit is not expected to drop below $700 billion. There is an inordinate amount of obfuscation in Obama's budget. It has many moving parts, like the proposed cutting of 120 programs that will garner $20 billion and a fee, not a tax, mind you, on the country's biggest banks that will raise $90 billion. There is also a freeze on non-defense discretionary spending that may save $250 billion over 10 years. But the freeze is only in effect for 3 years, and then those outlays will be indexed to inflation. But the problem of all this debt and fiscal profligacy is here. Every dollar of debt is a promise to tax that same dollar in the future and interest. Estimates indicate that the publicly traded debt will rise to $18.5 trillion by 2020. And to compare, the total national debt outstanding today is already an unbelievable $12.3 trillion, and the publicly traded portion of that debt is $7.7 trillion. Publicly traded debt will increase from $7.7 trillion to $18.5 trillion. A country cannot rescue the private sector by moving the debt to the public sector. In truth, the private sector hasn't been bailed out at all. The public sector has just been mortally wounded. But there will be no one around to bail out the United States in the future. The country has delayed and exacerbated the inevitable confrontation with its debt. How can the U.S. go hat in hand to China and ask them to let their currency rise, which means that they will have fewer dollars to buy treasuries, and at the same time ask them to increase their purchase of treasuries to the tune of almost $11 trillion in the next 10 years? Does that sound like a credible strategy or a sound plan for America? The powers that be have failed to recognize that the true nature of the problem is America's debt. Their failures to allow the nation to deleverage and to use the taking on of more debt as the panacea will lead to a crisis more severe than the one most think we have avoided. Exasperating. All right, this is Richard Martin. This is the Richard Martin wake-up call. And always please do call into the show. It makes it lively, it makes it interesting, and it makes it nice for me to be able to field some of your questions live. And the number for that is toll-free, 888-873-4643. Once more, the toll-free number to get to the show right now for the next 50 minutes is 888-873-4643. Well, if you like to send in your questions by email, that's also, as always, the second best alternative, and you write to me. My email is open right now, and it is rm@gfawd.com. Once more, RM for Richard Martin, GFAWD for Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design .com. Once more, rm@gfawd.com. My phone number, my direct line for those who'd like to call me in private with questions about their finances or other matters of personal interest, would be a number in Sarasota, which is area code 941-441-1682. That number will come straight through to me in Singapore, and I will endeavor to pick up my phone and answer you, and if not, please leave a message with your phone number, and I will call you back. Once more, the number is 941-441-1682. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we had, I think, an interesting show last night. The discussion group that we're talking more and more in detail now about what it is that motivates the powers that be to make the ridiculous decisions and financial organizations and arrangements on behalf of the taxpayer, knowing full well that it is all leading into a kind of giant financial Armageddon. And we are dancing around this a little bit with some, I think, interesting anecdotes about things which are happening. And I, as always, would encourage you to call in. We are really digging quite down deep into this, I think. And it is a little painful, I think, to have to endure. But I think once we have really got to the bottom of this whole motive for these government people to take these kamikaze, suicidal decisions on behalf of the American people, we'll see really what it's all about, and possibly that makes it more easy to tolerate. It won't improve the situation, but it will make it easier to stomach, to digest what's going on. So anyway, that's our Sunday show, which we will continue with the same topic next Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern time. One other thing I have, a little housekeeping here. A message from our archivist, who's Joe, who has asked me to let you know that he has uploaded podcasts to iTunes for the shows, and what we need to know is that you can visit the archives page for the links, or you can search for the name of the show, The Wake Up Call, or Rich Martin's Wake Up Call, or you can just put in the Progressive Radio Network on iTunes, and this will let you automatically subscribe to all new episodes. And obviously you can listen to these podcasts on your computers, your iPods, mobile phones. So remember, there's a new way in to the show right now for those of you who commute by car and feel that the dulcet tones of The Wake Up Call are appropriate for the ride. Okay. Well, I just thought I would give you some meat on the bones of this ridiculous government stimulus, which of course has had absolutely no effect, and I propose to tell you why. The homeowner vacancy rate increased to 2.7%, from 2.6% in the third quarter, according to the U.S. Census Bureau in a recent report. There were 2.09 million empty properties on the market, up from 1.99 million, according to the report. The rate gained even as the number of properties listed with brokers declined, because the survey includes bank-owned homes for sale without a realtor. Foreclosures probably will reach 3 million this year, surpassing the record of 2.82 million in 2009, according to Irvine, California-based Realty Track, Inc. And I quote, "The vacancy rate captures all the properties that are being held off the market by banks, so it shows how much excess inventory there really is." And that's from Patrick Newport, an economist at IHS Global Insight in Lexington, Massachusetts. You see, banks can hide their inventory so as not to flood the market with sales, thereby skewing the figures. But statistics pertaining to vacancy rates simply do not lie. Almost 4.5% of mortgaged U.S. homes were in foreclosure during the third quarter, the highest rate in 37 years of tracking, according to the Mortgage Bankers Association on November the 19th. About one in every 10 mortgages was at least one payment overdue in the period. The rate was 2.9% in the first and fourth quarters of 2008, the highest shown by census records dating to 1956. There were 18.9 million vacant homes in the fourth quarter, including foreclosures, residences for sale, and vacation homes, up from the 18.8 million in the third quarter, according to today's census report. The home ownership rate, meaning households that own their own residence, was 67.2%, down from 67.6%, according to the report. Foreclosures are included in a part of the Census Bureau that also includes vacation homes intended for year-round use and homes that are unoccupied because they are under renovation or tied up in legal proceedings. There were 7.69 million such properties empty in the fourth quarter, up from 7.65 million in the third quarter, according to the report. Foreclosures could also be counted as vacant homes for sale or rent, or as owner-occupied properties, if lenders haven't yet evicted previous owners. Government efforts included a tax credit of up to $8,000 for home buyers, spurred a 4.9% rise in sales last year, the first increase since 2005, according to the National Association of Realtors. The increase paired the number of homes listed for sale with brokers to 3.29 million in December, the lowest since March 2006. In early November, the President signed a bill extending the tax rate credit into 2010. The new version keeps the $8,000 first-time homebuyer benefit and makes a smaller credit available to some move-up buyers. To qualify, people must have a signed contract on a property by the end of April and purchase it before July the 1st. The extension of the credit may do little to help the housing industry in 2010, according to Newport. And I quote, "The market was propped up by the original tax credit, and now we are starting to see underlying weakness. The extension of the credit so far is not having much of an effect." Well, I have to wonder, really, as I do on my Sunday evening program, what the motive is for the government to do these things. They know far better than any of us can what the reality of the situation is, and I assure you that when they tell you that these various stimulus programs are going to jumpstart the economy, they know very well that that is not the case. They are lying through their teeth. I mean, I have access to a amount of information, but these have access to any amount of information more than I do. And I absolutely assure you they know what is going to happen. And, you know, where we have to extrapolate this information by digging for every piece of evidence we can find, these people have it all in front of them on a daily basis. So I don't know really how we're going to come to terms with this, but it's going to be very, very ugly indeed. Very ugly. Well, the delinquencies on the FHA-insured loans are blowing through every historical benchmark of sustainability. And this wouldn't be such a problem if this happened a few years ago. FHA was insuring a tiny part of the market. But that is now no longer the case. In 2009, FHA-insured loans backed up $306 billion in loans. That amounts to 30% of all home purchases, 20% of all refinances, and a jaw-dropping 50% of all new buyers. Without the FHA insuring loans, there would be a very different housing market. It would be one thing if FHA actually imposed strict guidelines, but right now we're heading into another mega bailout because giving loans to people with 3.5% down, which is actually near zero with the tax credit, is simply repeating history. Over 14% of FHA insured loans are now in some stage of delinquency. This is horrible. The overall market that is a mess is slightly above 9%. And some FHA-backed lenders are pumping out enormous amount of toxic mortgages that it has caught the eye of regulators. As we have learned, you must be doing a Bernie Madoff to catch the eye of regulators. Actually, I take that back. Bernie Madoff flew under the SEC radar for years, and only his fund implosion led him to his demise. And his fund only imploded because the whole market imploded, and he couldn't find any more buyers to take up the slack. Ladies and gentlemen, this is going to be another major bailout just waiting for us in 2010, something akin to the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. FHA-insured loans have exploded from 2007 by a factor of four because of the toxic mortgage market disappearing. So what are they doing to tighten standards on FHA-insured loans? According to CNN, and I quote, the FHA will also require borrowers to have at least a credit score of 580 to qualify for the agency's 3.5% down payment program. Those with lower score have to pay at least 10%. However, this rule may have little practical effect since Stevens recently said the average borrower score is 693. The new policy also would reduce the amount of money sellers can provide to home buyers at closing to 3%, down from 6% of the home's price. That change would bring the agency in line with industry standards and remove the incentive to inflate appraisals. End of quote. Subprime starts at a score of 620. The problem, of course, is you have people buying homes with nothing or close to nothing down. That is the issue. As we learned, or maybe are still learning, with Alt-A loans, you can have a solid 800 FICO with an income of 100,000 a year, but if you take out a 750,000 mortgage, you are destined to fail, and your FICO score will quickly plummet overnight. Instead of increasing the down payment requirement, the FHA is now pushing for higher premiums, which will actually hurt homeowners. But guess what? It'll benefit those making the loans on the front end. After all, if you require people to put some skin in the game, then the market would slow down because we are in a deep recession. Shouldn't we focus on fixing the employment problems first before trying to grease the wheels for people to buy homes? Why don't we all become real estate agents and mortgage brokers and sell homes to one another? The fact that they are hiking up premiums only means borrowers are going to pay more for the front-end problems and lack of underwriting on a monthly basis. And these loans are imploding at a quick pace. The median down payment is 3.5% or $9,888 in California. But with the tax credit, it is the cost of 1 month of rent. So we went from toxic no-doc pretend Alt-A and option ARM products to virtually no down payment FHA-insured loans that basically look at your W-2, and as long as your FICO isn't subprime, you're good to go. Banks are squeezing people into loans like an elephant trying to fit into a two-piece bikini. Do you think they actually do a thorough analysis of your overall household budget? What do they care? Once the loans are backed by the government, it's off their hands. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is how perverse the current system has become. We went from conventional 30-year mortgages with 20% down payments to a system where basically checking your W-2 is considered due diligence. Oh, okay, so basically because we aren't pretending that people working at Walmart making $150,000 a year, that somehow we are now practicing prudent lending? Over 14% of all FHA-insured loans are now in distress. 14%. They are months away from eating away their reserve and going for a bailout. Take, for example, the Southern California market. You have nearly 40% of all homes sold last month going through FHA-insured loans. Then you have roughly 25% of purchases with all-cash buyers. There is nothing normal about this market. And from this, we can gather the following. The vast majority of people are strapped for cash, even for a down payment. Those cash buyers are thinking they can flip that home to people in the future. The cash flow prices still don't make sense unless you look at some inland empire areas. With FHA-insured loans and the fact that they back 4 out of 10 purchases in Southern California, we can safely assume we'll be seeing a bailout in this industry in 2010. Keep in mind that this is even more troubling because these are supposedly bread and butter 30-year fixed loans. So what? With no job or lost wages, it can be a 200-year fixed rate, but if you don't have the monthly nut, you don't have the monthly nut. You can't squeeze a mortgage payment out of a turnip. How about we focus on fixing the economy first before trying to satisfy the banking industry's nostalgic desires to bring back the housing bubble? Every time you hear someone say, "We want affordable housing," you can call them a liar, because the market is bringing prices back down to what people can realistically afford. HAMP, FHA-insured loans, moratoria, the Fed artificially lowering mortgage interest rates by buying up $1.25 trillion in mortgage-backed securities, all create a sort of artificial market. In fact, it just makes homes unaffordable. The only real winners here are the banks, but I'm sure this is something you already know. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, I guess it's, well, time for our little break here. So, little break we will have. I'll be back just in a few moments.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Thoughtful, provocative, cutting edge. The Ask Dr. Eisenstein Show. Other doctors will scare you of the disease. Dr. Eisenstein will scare you of their treatment. Dr. Eisenstein is a practicing physician for almost 40 years and graduate of several prestigious medical schools. Since 1973, he has been the medical director of Home First Health Services in Chicago. The majority of the 23,000 families in this practice deliver their babies at home, breastfeed their children, choose not to vaccinate, and use natural treatments whenever possible.
Hi, I am Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. If you want to hear the other side of the story, tune in every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for an hour of questions, answers, and lively discussion. Call me with your medical questions. I would love to talk with you.
Are you a conscious college student? If you're interested in progressive news and politics, we want to hear from you. The Progressive Radio Network is looking for radio hosts to discuss college life and the issues dealing with being in a university. Send an email to karalee@garynoll.com, K-A-R-A-L-E-E at garynoll.com, or call 646-307-4482 and tell me your radio experience and any idea you could contribute to PRN. Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
Hello. Check out my show, The Animal Magnet Pet Radio, live every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern on Progressive Radio Network. Or catch it anytime you like by scrolling through the archives. You'll hear me, Deborah Wolf, best-selling author and award-winning radio host, chatting with the best pet experts and animal A-listers in the world about controversial topics like breed bans, the indoor versus outdoor cat debate, and whatever else is hot in the news and on their minds that matters to animals and the people who love them. Plus, we tell pet jokes, we'll give you trivia and smart, quirky facts, recipes, and take-home tricks and tests, homework your pets will love. Email your pet problems to me and we'll solve them on air. So listen to The Animal Magnet on Progressive Radio Network and get your animal fix.
I'm Elaine Snuffa, host producer of Evolving Ideas. Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, and global on the Internet. Join me each week on the Progressive Radio Network to explore the universe and our relationship to it.
You are listening to Progressive Radio Network.
Okay, well, I believe we're back again. So let me just remind you about CDSs. Remember, we had talked about the derivatives market time back, and they're coming into the news again. So I thought I would just update you and briefly remind you what collateralized debt obligations are. They're called CDOs. And they are, of course, among the new financial products that were developed following the widespread adoption of securitization, so-called. And they are claims on payment flows coming from a pool or pool of assets. And these assets, called collateral, are held by an accounting entity created for the purpose, often called a special purpose vehicle or entity, and the cash flows that derive from these assets are bought by investors. Thus, for example, a CDO structure might comprise a pool of car loans, corporate loans, and credit card loans, which are the collateral, and the repayments from these loans become the cash flows to the investor. The investor pays money to buy a portion of these flows, called a tranche, depending on his or her desire to hold risk. The first repayments on these loans go to what are called the senior tranches, and the next set go to the junior tranches, and the last set of payments goes to the equity tranches. Being first in line, and therefore facing less risk, means that the investors earn less in senior tranches than in junior and equity tranches. There are numerous variants of CDOs. The ones I just described are often called cash flow, since the major way in which the investor earns returns is through the cash flows from the underlying asset pools. In a market value CDO, investors earn returns by investing in a special purpose entity which buys and sells collateral assets, much in the way a mutual fund buys securities to earn capital gains. In a synthetic CDO, the investor doesn't have claims on a pool of assets directly, but through being party to a credit default swap agreement on a pool of assets. As long as the underlying loans do not default, according to this agreement, the investor will earn a premium. If the assets default, however, the investor will be out of the capital used to purchase the swap. As with the cash flow CDO in the synthetic CDO, the investor can choose the level of risk and return he or she is willing to take by choosing the tranche equity, the assets on which the CDS is written at default. The CDO market grew by leaps and bounds between 2000 and 2005. In 2005-2006, over $500 billion of these securities were issued. Not everyone is a fan. Warren Buffett, for example, suggests that the spread risk more widely. Such instruments serve to increase the uncertainty about the value of the pool of assets. Well, I'm going to talk about CDOs more on Friday, but I just wanted to give you a heads up as to what we were discussing. And I did, in fact, give several very in-depth talks about this several years ago before this whole problem blew up, because I knew that we would be needing to discuss it rather rapidly, and of course we have had to discuss it rather rapidly, and my worst suspicions and fears were of course realized, and the world has never been the same since. So, basically, that's where we stand with that. Now, I'm still hoping that we'll get some calls. People would like to ask a few questions. The number is the same. It didn't change since half an hour ago. It is 888-873-4643. And it is the toll-free number. Some of you will have views and opinions on different things, and you know, it's nice to hear from you. So please do feel free to call in, and we'd love to hear from you. In the meantime, we'll take a couple of pieces of mail that came in. We have a piece from Lyman, or Limon. I don't know how you pronounce your name, L-I-M-O-N. Limon, I'm going to say it's Spanish, but who knows? I'm not familiar with the name. Anyway, dear Richard, I appreciate your effort to let people know about the dark side of the financial world. I have listened to your program only three times. I think I could grasp the picture of troublesome times ahead, and I hope any human being with common sense and rational thinking should not have any doubt about the forthcoming problems. I would like to hear more about solutions. More specifically, what should we do? It certainly has two parts. Firstly, what should we do to protect our wealth? And obviously, some people asked this question before. To me, you provided them with the correct answer, as you are into wealth management. However, second obvious question would be, how can we generate wealth? I'm not talking about making big money, but how to survive in a decent life. And with the gloomy employment scenario ahead, what should one do to earn bread and butter? You can take my life as a case study. I am in Australia. I will complete my studies this year. I have very small savings, 5,000 Australian dollars, and no loans. It is not big capital to start something, and I'm not willing to take a loan from the bank. I might ask for some other sources, but the amount wouldn't be big. How should I prepare so that I can weather the storm? I again thank you for your effort. Regards, Limon. Well, there's a lot there to talk about, Limon, and a lot I have already discussed, and a lot doubtless I will discuss in the future. So we're going to, you know, paint this very thin here. Let's take the last part of your very interesting email. I appreciate all that you say. 5,000 Australian dollars and no loans. This is not the time to be thinking in terms of starting a new business, Limon. This is something that's very hard for people to appreciate as prices come down, and they think that there's, you know, a big bargain to be had in some favored area of business that they've had their eye on for several years, and suddenly it sort of seems to have come into focus. There is absolutely nothing gained by trying to start a new business right now. We are, again, in a period of heavy deflation, where the price of everything falls, where people lose their jobs, their homes, their livelihoods, as often as not, tragically, their marriages. It is a total breakdown of society that we're looking at dead ahead, Limon. And the idea that you should wade in with some kind of new business that's going to turn you into a multimillionaire overnight, it ain't going to happen. Please, be patient. Keep your $5,000. Keep studying. If you want to study some more, that's great, but keep out of trouble for the next 3 or 4 years. Yes, no, don't take any loans from banks, and don't go to any other sources. You know, there's nothing that you can do to prepare, you know, for this. And this takes me, of course, to the two-part question. You know, you want the solutions to the problems. Well, I don't have them, Limon. There aren't any. And I wish a few more people would simply step up to the plate and admit the obvious. This is a moment of breakdown. This is a part in the economic cycle of the downdrift, the Kondratiev cycle that we were talking about the other day, the winter, where everything goes to pot, everything breaks down, companies go bankrupt. There is a massive realignment of forces within the economic system. This means that there are no solutions. What should we do? It's what you should do, frankly, in the storm. You stay out of the rain. You get under a bridge and you cower there and you wait for the rain to stop. You know, you cannot stop rain by looking up into the sky and saying, you know, rain, go away, you know. It doesn't happen. You've got to wait it out. You've got to understand when the forces of the economy are stronger than you. This is really the secret to survival here, is not to think that you are more powerful than the system. Nobody is more powerful. Not you, not me. Not Geithner, Bernanke, Obama, nobody is going to be able to manipulate this system to their advantage, except those who play the market on the downside, who actually can make very, very good money, simply by playing along with the trend of the market, which is down. And this can be done, and it is done, it's very legal, and basically something that people can do if they get the right information. But, you know, the idea that, you know, what we should do to protect our wealth, apart from nothing, is very, very heinous and very troubling to me. Because, you know, people have indeed, as you say, Limon, asked this question before. But the second part of your question as to how we can generate wealth just can't be done. If you happen to be lucky in your inner business, you know, like shoe repair, where people tend to repair shoes more because they can't afford new shoes, or in certain aspects of the food business, or certain aspects of the social services which are indispensable, you're probably going to survive. But that's about as far as it goes, and I'm sorry to be, you know, so seemingly pessimistic. I don't call it pessimistic, by the way, I call it realistic. And we had an interesting, I read an interesting article about that on the Sunday show last night, basically, you know, the cure for optimism, which was an article that came out in the New York Times a few weeks ago. There isn't a cure for optimism, there is only realism, so please bear that in mind. Thank you, Limon. Then Irene says, "Hi, Richard. I'm wondering how you feel about CDs as a safe haven. I have some money with Vanguard in a Treasury money market account. This is a rollover IRA account. If it becomes necessary to liquidate that account, I could purchase CDs through Vanguard and still have the money in a rollover IRA account. This would be preferable rather than cashing out the money market account and paying the tax due. Thanks very much, Richard." You can certainly buy CDs. That's not a problem. I don't know why you would be paying tax on a money market account, but it's a question of getting a higher yield. If you buy short-term CDs, that's to say a year or less, I won't have a problem. But don't go long-term. That's all I suggest. Whatever you do, don't take long-term bond investments, because I think you will be clobbered. Stay away from the long-term. Stay short-term. All right, then we had Simone, who wrote in, "Hi, Richard. I'm not sure what to make of this. Can you talk more about this on an upcoming show?" And this is subsequent to a comment that I placed on the email distribution system that I have that goes out to those who are interested, in which I said the following. "If the United States government were to nationalize every penny of private wealth accumulated by American citizens since the nation's founding 235 years ago, the government would remain totally bankrupt." Well, Simon, what that basically means is that the entire wealth of the country, the private wealth of the country, if you simply gave it as a Christmas present to the U.S. government, would still not pay down its debts. It still would not have the wherewithal to pay off all its debts. It is a frightening and frightful statistic. But unfortunately, it's true, and it is as simple as that, Simone. So hopefully you did get it. Ralph wrote in, basically I had written another comment, and Ralph picked up on it, and the comment was as follows. "Furthermore, with the budgetary equivalent of a straight face, the Office of Management and Budget reports in its long-term intergenerational budget projection that the United States government will experience massive non-stop deficits for the next 70, that's 70, years, requiring the issuance of tens of trillions of dollars of additional debt. The Office of Management and Budget does not project even 1 year of surplus during the entire 70-year budget period." And Ralph's question is, does that mean that the dollar will eventually collapse? But when? No, in and of itself, it doesn't mean that, as a matter of fact, Ralph. It doesn't mean that at all. You want to understand that the dollar is not a statement of the comparison of well-being of one country versus another, in this case, the dollar versus other countries. The dollar is a special currency because it is the world's reserve currency. In other words, the currency that people use, or perhaps it's truer to say have used up until now, as the as a measure of debts and inter-country and corporate payments between different nations. They've tended to use the dollar. And that makes the dollar a different type of animal for other currencies which are more related to the economies of those countries. And one of the reasons that the dollar has been rising right now is because people have had to scramble to get hold of those dollars to pay debts of one sort or another, given that the amount of dollars in circulation has been falling through the defaults and the bankruptcies and basic debts of one sort or another that have failed. So, no, the statements I had read about the intergenerational budget projection really doesn't concern the dollar. And if the dollar does indeed collapse, it won't be because of the intergenerational budget projection. Of course, the figures are so staggeringly awful that they defy the imagination. There is nobody really that can properly wrap their brains around these figures. So it is just sufficient for you all to know that indeed the United States government will not, under any circumstances, be able to pay off all this debt. So what remains to be seen, frankly, is how they will renege on that debt. And just going back to real estate a moment, there are 2 million U.S. homes sitting vacant with a for sale sign. There is another 3.4 million homes that are vacant but are being held off the market for unspecified reasons. In other words, the shadow inventory of foreclosed units that has yet to be listed. There are an additional 3.5 million homes that are occupied but listed for sale right now. There are 235,000 newly built units sitting vacant too. There are a record 4.6 million vacant rental lots nationwide that are competing for all this outstanding supply of houses, and rents are deflating at a record rate, which is impeding the relative improvement in the costs of home ownership. So we supply both potential and actual of over 9 million homes and condos nationwide. That is a huge overhang. On top of that, an 11% plus rental vacancy rate as a viable option for households looking for a place to live. Very terrible, terrible statistics, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you do somehow appreciate the enormity of what I've just told you. Well, we have Henry from New York who'd like to talk about housing and banking structure. Hello, Henry.
Good morning, Richard.
Henry? Hello, Henry.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Hi, how
please.
Are you? Okay. I want to make a quick comment on the economy and also housing market, but I'll just, for a quick second, piggyback on the question that was raised earlier just now on that email about the American currency, or the dollar, as we would call it. I think one quick way of explaining how the dollar works is that the U.S. could actually change its currency and still leave the dollar as a form of international dealing between corporations and countries, where they could actually use the dollar as an instrument of trade, and the dollar still remain relevant. As far as, in other words, the U.S. could, just like you would have gold, hey, well, okay, you can't print any more dollars apart from what's in circulation, and you could actually change your own currency and use whatever you want to use in your country as your means of trade. And that would still leave the dollar as a viable option for world trade. So I think people misunderstand how the dollar is used compared to what the United States does, except for when they go printing more money, of course, to try to get it into circulation. But that's your field of expertise, not mine. I really wanted to say I asked this question on your show previously via email to explain to the public or to us as listeners what's the fixation with real estate. And when I say real estate, ownership of real estate, that we've got ourselves so accustomed to, are so indoctrinated into, that we can't see beyond anything else as far as an economy now, beyond real estate. We can't fix anything, we can't do anything unless we attack real estate and put all our resource behind somehow real estate. And to the point now that if it was so important and we wanted to secure it that much, why would we make these structured investment vehicle that actually on the back end destroy everything about real estate that was sacred? You know,
well, I think the answer to that, I think the answer to that question is that real estate in the early 20th century was really not held widely by the general public. Most people really rented their real estate. And it was only after the Second World War, when you had those prefabricated houses like Bedott Town in Long Island, where people were building really cheap houses, they found ways to build really inexpensive homes, that suddenly brought the concept of general ownership of the state into view and basically allowed people, for the very first time, to purchase real estate for a very small amount of money. And even in those days, mortgages were sort of maximum five-year, occasionally 10-year, and just very, very occasionally 15 years, but absolute maximum 15 years, and with a far higher down payment than was customary later on. And so the buying power of the dollar being so high that basically people were able to afford real estate, and actually they did buy real estate in great quantities, and there was no question of defaults or foreclosures or anything like that, because the banks that made the loans carried those through loans to fruition, which meant that they had the people come into their offices, they studied their financials, took it very seriously, they made their decisions, and then they would let you know several days later whether or not you had a loan. And people took those things seriously, and they took their mortgages seriously, they paid them, they went to fruition, they had mortgage burning parties, you know, at the end of the mortgage when the final payment was due. And houses were considered by the society to be the ultimate aim of the average American and the culmination of the American dream, everybody owning his own home.
Well, Richard, isn't
I have never... Yes.
Yes. Yes. Isn't... I'm thinking here a little bit. Isn't this somewhat historical and cultural, going beyond that, that maybe the power that was wielded by landowners was so favorable that in the psyche of the person they could figure out, if I can only be like that landowner who had a vote and no one else had a vote, that sort of power that wielded behind the ownership of property that still is in the psyche, that people that believe that their only way out is owning property, and that
no, I don't think so. I think it was a genuine effort to give people their own homes, so to make people, you know, a part of America. I mean, giving people, as it were, a share in America, like a share meaning, you know, of a company where you buy shares in the company, and therefore you have a vested interest in making sure that that company works out, going to shareholders' meetings, discussing the issues, votes for the directors, that kind of thing. In real estate terms, that was looking after your environment, making sure that the streets were clean, your lawn was mowed, that the environment was happy and basically prosperous because you owned a share, i.e. a home, in the community. And I think that that was the concept behind trying to wean people off the rental market. I think they had genuine good intentions. What happened subsequently, Henry, was that the state simply took over, and basically the corporate element and the banking element fused forces with the state and created these terrible toxic mortgages, which were passed off, you know, to faceless organizations in other parts of the country. and then you had the beginning of the end of the home ownership concept, where people had a stake. People simply had an interest in buying and selling houses as fast as possible and using them, you know, as a kind of grand speculation, and that was how it ended.
You know, this goes back to your discussion on the discussion group ties into it about self-destruction. I mean, if we are so in tune to ownership or having a part of where we live and how we live, how could we make such a small group of people come up with such an incredible, complicated, manipulated product that would sabotage the entire industry and the entire livelihood of the nation? Where did the breakdown occur? That's exactly right.
I mean, when it became evident to people that the whole system was unraveling in front of their eyes, there was just a general scramble to try to make as much of it as possible, and then basically to sort of sabotage the whole issue and let the whole thing go to pot. I mean, there were enough regulations. The Federal Reserve could have stopped this whole thing in its tracks at any given moment since about 1992 with all the regulations that it had on its books. And when people cry for more regulations, if there weren't enough regulations in the system, and blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, they are completely missing the point. There were and are sufficient regulations for the Federal Reserve to completely stop this whole thing dead. Henry, I've got to go. I'm sorry, Henry, I really apologize. We're at an end. This is it. The hour is up. We have to go. We'll talk again soon, but ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us. We will be back again on Friday, same place, same time. This is Richard Martin of The Wake Up Call saying bye-bye till then.